We want to use this space as long as we can to share the excitement we feel at the discoveries that the Lord has allowed us to find in the Bible. We're not trying to come up with sensational ways to read the Bible. We just want Christians to get excited about the Word of God again, because it's like the Lord of the Rings on steroids. The Bible is spectacular when you dig into it, and when you realize what's been covered up over the years by translators with a naturalistic bias. I don't think they were deliberately trying to deceive us. I just think that, well, we all know that there's only one God, and so these references to the other gods of the pagans around ancient Israel were just their imaginary friends. Nothing to see here. Move along. And so they would translate the names of, for example, the names of deities that were known to the Israelites as things like plague or pestilence. It's like, no, that's Dever or Reshef, who was known to the Greeks and Romans as Apollo. But you're translating it as plague because, well, you know, everybody knows he's not real. Well, yeah, but the early church fathers thought he was real. The apostles thought he was real. Hebrew prophets thought he was real. References to chief deities of the pagan pantheons around them. This is much more than just God favored this people and he just indiscriminately killed everybody else. You realize that there's actually a war going on, and that the people who were, I mean, they were welcome to come over to Israel's side. I mean, there's Moabite and Canaanite blood in Jesus' bloodline. But most of these people refused, and because they were sold out to these other gods. The overlap between what we were taught in school as Greek mythology or Roman mythology or Egyptian mythology and the Bible, it's like jaw-dropping. And secular scholars have seen this, I mean, for going on 25 years now.
Welcome to the Days of Noah podcast, where we talk all things biblical, supernatural, and strange. Luke and I are privileged today to bring on Derek Gilbert. Many of you may know his name from many of the books he has authored, his work over the years with Skywatch TV, alongside with the late Tom Horn, and others. And man, he has been in this space now for a couple decades. He and his wife Sharon, just talking about the true version of history that the Bible lays out, this polemic against the fake news version, the Mesopotamian Apkallu, that we're really the watchers coming down and sinning against all manner of creation and creating the chaos that led to the necessity of the flood for God to wipe the slate clean and preserve the line of the Messiah. Derek lays that case out very well in his books. The one that I read as prep for our chat is The Last Clash of the Titans. And really, just these Greek gods and mythologies, and these were actual beings that lived, that were worshipped, and were honored. And this is the backdrop against the Most High God of the Bible, El Elyon, the Most High God, against these other deities. We talk about Alexander Hislop and his book that led to many errors in our end times thinking, as he didn't quite do due diligence in his research putting together his book, The Two Babylons. We talk about Nimrod, the Tower of Babel, and just so many other things. And we look forward to having Derek back again in the not too distant future, hopefully with his wife Sharon, and we can get into more of these topics in greater depth. Guys, if you enjoy this episode, if you enjoy listening to the Days of Noah podcast, just take a moment to leave us a 5-star rating, leave a positive review if you're on Apple. It does help to spread the show to more people and get it seen as people are checking out podcasts to listen to. And share it with your family and friends. Send them a link, post it on your social media. We think these are very important conversations to be had understanding this Genesis 6 worldview that is largely underrepresented in the body of Christ today. And unfortunately, many of our church leaders are not being taught what's really in the pages of our Bible. So with that, let's get into our conversation with Derek Gilbert. Well, we welcome Derek Gilbert to the Days of Noah podcast. We are privileged to have you, Derek. Luke was just telling you that we've been fans of yours for years, and you have a plethora of books in your arsenal that you've written. The one that I picked out to read as kind of prep for today, at least to get to know your style, was Last Clash of the Titans. And man, right from the first chapter, you really nailed, encapsulated the premise of our show, that the days of Noah are going to return, are returning, and Jesus said it. And what does that mean? And so that's something that Luke and I have just tried to really dig in, and having a platform that's, you know, slowly growing, and it really makes you dive in and go, okay, if I'm saying this, I need to know, I need to know if I'm right on this, or at least be convinced on eschatological things and historical and all of that. But yeah, welcome, Derek.
Oh, it's an honor to be here. Any podcast with a name like the Days of Noah, that's I figure that's probably talking about stuff that's right in my wheelhouse.
For sure.
In terms of my interests, maybe not expertise, but at least in things that I find interesting.
Yeah, there you go.
Absolutely.
Well, Luke and I often say we were inspired by Nate and Luke on Blurry Creatures to do this show. And that's kind of, I felt that prompting by the Holy Spirit that these are important topics to connect the historical, biblical, supernatural, and then what's coming. But yeah, I mean, just maybe just introduce kind of yourself as far as your background and testimony and how it led up to talking about these topics. Because, I mean, you're one of the OGs in the space with L.A. Marzulli and as Luke mentioned, Tom Horn and others who have been talking about some of these topics for decades where, you know, I don't know, Luke, was it only 10 or less than 15 years ago that we even heard of something called Nephilim, even though it was right in the Bible?
Right. Yeah. It was around that time frame with Randy Domain's interview on Patricia King's yes. Show
I remember on God TV. Yeah, I remember that.
And picked up his books and started down the rabbit trails. And
I've got a background in secular broadcasting. Got started when I was in college, and as a kid growing up, when all my normal friends were listening to late night, you know, top 40, like WLS or WCFL in Chicago, disc jockeys like John Records Landecker, Captain Whammo, Sky Daniels, I was listening to the late night talk show hosts because that's what I found interesting, because I am wired weirdly. My friends were listening to music and I was listening to Dr. Milton Rosenberg and, Chicago Eddie Schwartz and, you know, the late night talk show guys in Chicago. And that's what I wanted to do when I grew up, you know, other than, you know, play third base for the Cubs, which you need some physical skills for that. I mean, believe it or not, meritocracy is still a thing in certain aspects of our society. Anyway, got to college, got involved in the campus radio station, and then realized that when you're 18, 19 years old, nobody needs a talk show host because you don't really know anything. So I wound up in top 40 radio from 1983 until the early 90s. Went from Galesburg, Illinois to Peoria to Philadelphia, which was quite a jump. I mean, market number 125 to market number, I think it was market number 4 at the time, wow. New York, LA, Chicago, Philadelphia, in terms of market size. And then Little Rock, St. Louis. And then it was about that time, after getting fired by a long distance phone call the day before Thanksgiving, began to realize by this time I'd married, had a daughter, very young daughter, and began to think that maybe there was a better way to provide for my family. So I started looking for an escape out of broadcasting. That led me into retail for a little while. I managed a tuxedo shop. Then my first marriage began to fall apart. Late 90s, I met Sharon, and this was very early in the internet. I think only 20% of America was online, and yet we met online. We were early adopters in the, you know, online dating scene. And for God's reasons, you know, me in St. Louis, when I was filling out the questionnaire for this, joining this website, because I figured there had to be a better way to meet somebody you'd want to spend a long term with than going to bars. I tried that when I was, you know, in my early 20s, and that didn't work out so well. And one of the questions was, how far would you be willing to travel to meet somebody? I thought, well, if this is somebody worth spending the rest of my life with. So I checked the box that said 200 miles. And my friends thought I was crazy because, you know, I was singing with a barbershop quartet at the time and, you know, telling the guys what I was going through. Our lead singer commiserated. He was having his own relationship troubles. But they thought I was crazy. But there's 2.5 million people in the St. Louis metro area. You can't find somebody local. Well, who knows? Well, it turns out after Sharon and I connected online, she was in Bloomington, Indiana, that as a crow flies from where I lived to her location was about 195 miles. So if I had checked the boxes that said 20 miles, 10 miles, whatever, we may never have met. But, you know, so I think the Lord had a hand, as I hear, nudge the kid, you know, tell him to do this. And she was very patient with me because when we met, you know, as I was going through the breakup of the relationship, I realized at one point, and again, I think this was the Holy Spirit kind of nudging me, that although I was the custodial parent of our daughter, I didn't really know how to explain to her what's right and what's wrong, because I couldn't really articulate my own worldview. On what basis do I view the world? And I thought, well, okay, the Bible seems like a good moral compass, but what if it's like they say, and it's just a bunch of myths and legends made up by a nomadic tribal leader in the desert, you know, 3,400 years ago. So I began doing some reading on apologetics, read The Case for Christ by Lee Strobel, Evidence That Demands a Verdict by Josh McDowell. And that convinced me, especially reading the story of James, the half-brother of Jesus, and how he was martyred in the about 30 years after the resurrection. There was a kind of an interregnum where the Roman, whatever the term was for the office that Pontius Pilate had held, procurator, governor, whatever. Anyway, he had died. And so the Jews took advantage of that to put James to death because the subject people in the Roman Empire were not supposed to, you know, they did not have the right under Roman law to administer capital punishment. That was reserved for the Romans. So they took advantage of a break in the government there to put James to death. Well, when you read in the book of Galatians and the book of in 1 Corinthians, Galatians 1, 1 Corinthians 15, you put that together, you realize that James was one of the leaders of the early church. Paul went to James and Peter after his time in Arabia to find out whether what he had heard from the brothers in Damascus was true. And then in his letter to the church at Corinth in 1 Corinthians 15, Paul tells them, all of this stuff about the literal bodily resurrection of this Jesus is true, and it's really, really important. Because, and then he goes through the list. He appeared first to Peter, and then to James, and then to 500 at once, some of whom have fallen asleep, but most are still awake. In other words, if you don't believe me, send somebody to Jerusalem and ask around to confirm that what I'm telling you is true, because the resurrection is really central to Christian doctrine. It is essential. If you don't believe that in literal bodily resurrection of Jesus Christ, you are not in any meaningful sense a true Christian. And that hit me like a ton of bricks. Like, wait a minute. James would have been in a position to know if the resurrection had been faked, like some of the conspiracy theories out there. And if Jesus really did rise from the dead, then everything that he said about the Old Testament, about Moses and Abraham, and then that's all real. Oh, I've got some thinking to do. So that started me down a journey. But at the time Sharon and I met, I was still arguing that there was no contradiction between Darwinian evolution and the book of Genesis. So, and, you know, besides the contradictory accounts of how the creation came into being, there's the problem of sin. If we just evolved from lower life forms, then sin has always been with us and the Bible's a lie. So anyway, I was still trying to argue that, you know, you didn't have to throw out Darwin, and she again, was patient enough to let the Holy Spirit work on me until I got to where I was like, oh yeah, that's like cognitive dissonance there, that you can't have it both ways. So anyway, that kind of started me down the rabbit trail of apologetics, which I guess in a broad sense is where we've been led over the last 25 years. We just celebrated our 26th anniversary, actually. Late 90s, early 2000s, we started digging into things like the Nephilim. In fact, the first book I ever read about the Nephilim was L.A. Marzulli's novel titled Nephilim, which was the only book in our local library branch in St. Louis County on the subject. So I blame Marzulli for all of this.
There you go. And that was in the early 2000s or 90s?
That was in the early 2000s.
Okay.
After hearing an evangelist preach on Genesis 6 at a small independent Baptist church that we were members of for a while, I'd never heard about that.
Yeah.
You know, my parents had raised my sister and me going to church every Sunday morning where the Bible was presented as a guidebook for how to live, which, okay, it is on a surface level, but at a deeper level, it's much more important than that. And it turns out, after we've begun to research this and really dug into it, with the luxury, really, the privilege of being able to do this full-time for the last 9 years, since Tom Horn offered us the opportunity to partner with Skywatch TV, that the Nephilim, the giants, whose spirits, after the flood of Noah, became the demons that are with us to this day, that's really central to understanding Christian theology. So digging into that and kind of pulling on those threads was kind of where we began. We began writing fiction in the early 2000s. Sharon has always been a writer. When we met, I told her, I can't write. I'm not a writer. I was like, well, now I've got, I keep losing track. I don't know, 8 or 9 books, a couple co-authored with Sharon, one co-authored with Josh Peck, but 2 novels and like 5 nonfiction books. And we've got another co-authored book, Sharon and me, coming out later this year called The Gates of Hell.
Well, you can't work at Skywatch and not come out with a book.
So. Yeah.
That's part of
the publishing company.
Yeah. That's part of the deal. When Tom brought us in, he said, okay, you've written some chapters for me for some of the anthologies that he put out there. I want you to write a full book. It's like, okay. But, you know, it's more work than people think, but it really is a joy, especially the detective work of digging into what secular scholars have turned up in the ancient pagan texts. And as we began doing our podcast called PID Radio back in 2005, which was originally intended to market our novels, we were co-writing in the same fictional universe, but you know, and sharing characters and plot points, but writing independently. So she allowed me to borrow characters and plot devices from The Armageddon Strain, from my novel, The God Conspiracy. She took some of the characters from The God Conspiracy, inserted them back into a follow-up novel of hers. Winds of Evil was the original one. What was it? She's working on a follow-up as well in the modern day. So we're basically bringing what we were writing 20 years ago together with her Red Wings saga, which is 8 novels and counting, and bringing them together. So we'll be back to doing what we started out doing. But as it turned out, the podcast wasn't to market the novels. It was to get us to start talking to people like L.A. Marzulli and Tom Horn and Mike Heiser and Steve Quayle and Guy Malone and so on and so on. And doing what you guys are doing and what, you know, Nate and Luke at Blurry Creatures are doing and what the guys at the Camp Ramon podcast are doing. Digging in and getting fed, I mean, it really laid the groundwork for what we are doing now. I mean, we interviewed Tom Horn for the first time back in 2005 when he put together the first Future Congress in Branson in 2011. He invited us to come and bring our podcasting gear. And we did. And so we interviewed all the speakers. I did like 18 interviews in the course of 2.5 days. Wow. And then we did that again in 2012 and then again in 2013. And then they asked us if we would speak at a conference in 2013. And along the way, somebody got the bright idea to put a video camera in the room and then add these to the DVD sets as extras, you know, bonus 15-minute interviews with the likes of Chuck Missler and Dr. Tommy Ice and Joel Richardson. And so we got exposed to all of these really wonderful men and women of God and deep researchers. And then when Tom was getting ready to put Skywatch TV together, he asked if we would be willing to come down to the Ozarks. So Sharon, who had just written a short nonfiction book for Tom called Ebola and the Fourth Horseman of the Apocalypse, this was during the West African Ebola outbreak in 2014. She was one of the pilot episodes for Skywatch TV. And then he offered us the opportunity to move down here. And when we found out that part of the mission of Skywatch TV was not just to market, you know, to write and produce content for Defender Publishing, but all of that was to raise funds to operate Whispering Ponies Ranch, which is a ranch where miniature horses are used as therapy animals for children in the foster care system who are at much greater risk of being trafficked and falling into prostitution, drugs, gangs, prison, early death, you know, that kind of thing. This helps them break the cycle by showing them that there are adults out here who understand that our role as adults is to love and protect children, not use them for our own ends. And so that made the decision very easy. And we are just, the Lord has blessed us beyond measure. I mean, living here in the Ozarks, we moved here at just the right time because a few years later during the lockdowns, everybody wanted to come to the Ozarks and places like it to get out of the big cities. And so our real estate values have gone.
Oh, yeah.
And we'd have a much harder time affording this property today than we did 9 years ago. So we've been very, very blessed. And just over the last 9 months or so, we've moved from...
Welcome to the Lost Roman Heroes podcast. My name is Matthew.
And my name is Matteo.
We are serious nerds for Rome, and we are father and son.
Together on the Lost Roman Heroes podcast, we dive deep into the history of Rome, from its origin story starring Aeneas of Troy to its death with Constantine the 11th, uncovering Rome's greatest heroes along the way and ranking them.
There are plenty of great podcasts on the big men in Rome's history, guys like Caesar, Augustus, and Constantine, but that's not us. We're making this podcast to shed a light on Rome's forgotten heroes. From Cincinnatus to Scipio, from Aurelian to Belisarius and beyond, you will not believe the gems that we uncover. So please come join the Legion of Lost Roman Heroes and listen to us wherever you get your favorite podcasts, iTunes, Podbean, Spotify, or find us at www.lostromanheroes.com.
Well, over the last 2 years, we've started partnering with Skywatch TV instead of essentially serving as employees. My only responsibility at Skywatch TV now is doing the daily news update 5 and 10, trying to keep from going too far into politics and being, you know, rah-rah red team, you know.
Right.
And trying to analyze things from a Christian perspective. It's like, yeah, we see things are happening that aren't the way we would like them to be. But remember, look up, for your redemption draws near. You know, 2,000 years ago, Satan offered all of the kingdoms of the world to Jesus. They were his to give to whom he will. And I don't think there are exceptions there for countries that identify as democracies or representative republics. I think Satan is literally in control of the world system and all of the governments of it temporarily. So trying to bear that in mind and be encouraging while also informing people. The programs that we do now, which we started doing in our home, we had every bedroom in our home except the one we were sleeping in, turned into studio or office space, but that's all been moved into the building that we're in right now. We had the property that we bought for a steal, really. I mean, it was, you know, what the market was 9 years ago, but
yeah.
I mean, this was cheaper than the subdivision home that we sold at a small town in southern Illinois. And Illinois, not Illinois. Yes. I know better. I was born and raised there.
That's right.
A small town in Illinois. And we've got 10 acres to boot. And our neighbors are just cattle and coyotes occasionally. And again, we got this 30 by 40 foot building that came with it, which over the last year we've converted into usable office and studio space. So, our driving force now is, as the two of us are getting to an age where we're starting to slow down physically, hopefully not mentally, we want to use this space as long as we can to share the excitement we feel at the discoveries that the Lord has allowed us to find in the Bible. We're not trying to be innovative. We're not trying to come up with sensational ways to read the Bible. It's like, hey, click here. Look, right. Don't care about the clicks, okay? We just want Christians to get excited about the Word of God again, because it's like the Lord of the Rings on steroids.
Yes.
I think Tolkien and Lewis knew this, and they tried to convey it through fiction. That's what Sharon does with her fiction series. I've made a couple of minor attempts at trying to tell the story through fiction as well, working on a follow-up novel. But the Bible is spectacular when you dig into it, and when you realize what's been covered up over the years by translators with a naturalistic bias. I don't think they were deliberately trying to deceive us. I just think that, well, we all know that there's only one God, and so these references to the other gods of the pagans around ancient Israel were just their imaginary friends. Nothing to see here. Move along. And so they would translate the names of, for example, the names of deities that were known to the Israelites as things like plague or pestilence. It's like, no, that's Dever, that's or Reshef, who was known to the Greeks and Romans as Apollo. But you're translating it as plague because, well, you know, everybody knows he's not real. Well, yeah, but the early church fathers thought he was real. The apostles thought he was real. Hebrew prophets thought he was real.
Yeah, and Gary Wayne telling us that, you know, Tolkien wrote Lord of the Rings as an antediluvian epic, and now I'm watching the trilogy again for what, the third or fourth time. Every few years I go through it and seeing it with new eyes, you know, talking about they're building an army of these hybrid, you know, fighting Uruk-hai or whatever they were.
Uruk, which was the name of Nimrod's home city.
Uruk-hai. There you go. Oh, wow. It even got it from that. I didn't even know.
Yeah. Yeah. Uruk-hai.
Yeah. And then, you know, as I was communicating with you the last few weeks, you know, picking up a copy, an extra copy of your book, Last Clash of the Titans, as I have someone I know and care about who is fascinated by, you know, Percy Jackson and the Olympians.
Yeah.
And they're at that critical age of, you know, do I assimilate Christianity as true? Or do I, you know, she's kind of on the fence there. And it's like, yes, it is more fascinating than we've been given credit. And we need to talk about these things because Hollywood doesn't hold a candle to the Bible, because all of that stuff is derivative from the gods of Genesis 6 and the true God warring against them.
Mm-hmm. It's, and when you begin to understand that and you see that the references in the Bible to, for example, the Rephaim, usually translated as the shades or the dead or the departed, references to chief deities of the pagan pantheons around them, the references to Bashan or Mount Hermon in scripture and the supernatural implications of those locations, you begin to see that this is much more than just God favored this people and he just indiscriminately killed everybody else. And it's just totally not fair. You realize that there's actually a war going on, and that the people who were, they were welcome to come over to Israel's side. I mean, there's Moabite and Canaanite blood in Jesus' bloodline.
Right.
But most of these people refused, and because they were sold out to these other gods. And when you start pulling on those threads, again, you realize that there's a lot more meat in this Bible than we realize. And the overlap between what we were taught in school as Greek mythology or Roman mythology or Egyptian mythology and the Bible is like jaw-dropping.
Yes.
And secular scholars have seen this. I mean, for going on 25 years now, it's been known, and a growing number of scholars are coming around to this scholar's position. An Estonian scholar named Amar Anus wrote a paper in 1999 titled, Were There Greek Rephaim? And in this paper, it's like my head explodes, you know, as I'm reading the paper. I had to go back and reread it about 12 times to try to get all the information out of it that's in there. He shows it's a complex language explanation, okay, etymological analysis, But basically, he shows that the term used by the Greek poets for the men who lived during the golden age when Kronos ruled in heaven, okay, the demigod heroes of the pre-flood era, because the Greeks had a flood myth just like everybody else, that term, merapes, anthropoi, okay, anthropoi, like anthropology, that's where we get the Greek term for the study of humanity. So, okay, the merapes, that first word in that phrase, used by Hesiod, from whom we get most of what we know about Greek mythology, and Homer, the author of the Iliad and the Odyssey.
Yes.
For their demigod heroes of old, merapes, Anus showed, derives from the same Semitic root behind the Canaanite name Rapayuma and the Hebrew Rephaim. So the Greeks knew that their heroes were the Rephaim.
Yes.
They just, Hellenized the word. And what's more, Hesiod then goes on to write that when the men of that age died, they passed peacefully and their spirits became daemons. Hey, guess what? That's where we get the word demon.
Mm-hmm.
Except that the Greeks believed that they were kindly and helped humanity and delivered us from harm and things like that. So there is an overlap between what the pagans around ancient Israel believed and what the Greeks were taught, the Jews were taught, the Israelites were taught. And when you start pulling on those threads, I mean, that was really the inspiration for the book, Last Clash of the Titans, because the Watchers, the sons of God from Genesis chapter 6, who Peter and Jude both place in the bottomless pit. Peter specifically says they were thrust down to Tartarus, 2 Peter 2, verse 4. The English word hell in that verse is actually the Greek word Tartarosis, which means literally thrust down to Tartarus. Not Hades, it's a separate place reserved for supernatural threats to creation. And under the influence of the Holy Spirit, Peter used that word. It's the only place in the Bible that word is used, which, as Mike Heiser used to say, if it's in the Bible and it's weird, it's probably important.
Yes.
So this identifies those sinful angels from Genesis 6 as the group of supernatural rebels in Tartarus. The Greeks said, no, they're the old gods who were overthrown by the storm god Zeus, or Jupiter if you're Roman, who Jesus identified in Matthew 12 and Revelation 2 as Satan. So that's the fake news version of what happened.
Yes.
It wasn't the Olympians who overthrew the Titans and sent them down to the netherworld. In the Babylonian story, it was the chief god Marduk who sent the Apkallu down to the netherworld after a flood, no less. Again, same outlines as the story back in the book of Genesis, Genesis 7 through 9, but the fake news version.
Yes, and one thing I put in my notes in preparation for chatting today, Derek, is that there's no bad publicity. Because because all of these stories, all these other religions, all these pantheon of gods, and thank you for being in the age of information that we're in, we can talk about this and share this knowledge, but it all points to the true God now.
Yeah,
we can connect ancient things, UFOs, Marvel movies. We can connect it to the Bible. And speaking of that, you know, when I went through Joel Richardson's book, Mystery Babylon,
mm-hmm.
A couple times and really got a lot out of that. And I think he makes a pretty good case for the Antichrist and coming from the area, maybe in Saudi Arabia, the Mystery Babylon, that area. But one of the things, if I had a criticism maybe for him, would be maybe a little bit dismissive on the Freemasonic Illuminati sort of religion, that's that whole side of things. But he did give me some things to think about as far as Nimrod, because the Bible is kind of scant on the details of
right.
all of the stuff that we're taught about what Nimrod was doing and, you know, the original, you know, Freemason, if you will. And a lot of that comes from extra biblical sources. So maybe kind of help us understand Nimrod in those terms. And then another thing Joel Richardson brought up was Alexander Hislop and a lot of the ways that we understand end times and what's coming is from his work, which is unfortunate that he wasn't the best scholar. He's a bit sloppy in his scholarship. So maybe if you're able to connect kind of those two to help us understand Nimrod and maybe some of the errors that Hislop that we've all kind of gotten used to thinking about.
Right. Yeah. A lot of well-meaning pastors have used Hislop's book, The Two Babylons, which was published around 1860. And I've actually toyed with the idea of doing a book called The Annotated Hislop or The Annotated Two Babylons, just to go through and kind of point out where Hislop got it wrong. It really was twofold. Number one, we've discovered, I say we, archaeologists and epigraphers have discovered a lot of things. I didn't discover nothing. I just trying to put the puzzle pieces together. There have been a lot of things that have been found since 1860 that have changed our understanding of the ancient Near East. Secondly, Hislop had an axe to grind with the Roman Catholic Church, and he was really trying to make the evidence fit into a preordained conclusion, which is that Rome is bad and it's based on paganism. And I've written about this in a couple of my books. Nimrod gets kind of a bad rap because he was not connected to the city of Babylon. Now, assuming that Nimrod is, as was proposed by an Egyptologist named David Roll, the Sumerian king Enmerkar. Okay, he's mentioned in the Sumerian king list as the king of Uruk, which the Bible tells us was the center of Nimrod's kingdom, Erech. He, like Nimrod, is the second generation after the flood. As the Sumerians also remembered, a devastating flood. They will have a king list with a number of kings. Then the flood swept over. And then they come back in, and King of Uruk was, and I can't even, Meskiagashkar or whatever, was the first king. And then following him was this Enmerkar. If Nimrod is him, second generation after the flood, and this was a period in Mesopotamian history when Uruk, that city in what is now southeastern Iraq, was dominant in Mesopotamia, then it was probably in what is called by scholars the Uruk period, which roughly 3800, 3900 to about 3100 BC. That city for about 800-900 years dominated everything from the Persian Gulf to the Taurus Mountains of Turkey, between the Euphrates and the Tigris rivers. That ended around 3100 BC. Babylon wasn't founded until about 2200 BC, and even then it was a small, unimportant little village until the time of Hammurabi. The first six kings of Babylon, when Babylon became an independent kingdom around 1900 BC, didn't even call themselves king of Babylon because Babylon was so unimportant. So connecting Nimrod to Babylon is a mistake. Also, a scholar by the name of Stephanie Daly has written a very convincing paper showing how the name Babylon didn't always apply to the city ruled by Nebuchadnezzar. It is in Hebrew, it's the same word that is translated Babel into English. It's Bab El. It's the, means God gate or gate of gods. And it was applied to a number of cities, including Nineveh in Assyria. It was also applied to a city called Eridu, which is important because Eridu is probably where the Tower of Bab El was located. This is the oldest ziggurat ever found in Mesopotamia. It was the home of the god Enki, who was lord of the Apsu, or the Abzu, which means where we get the word abyss. It was the freshwater reservoir under the earth from which the Tigris and Euphrates sprang, which, of course, is very important to life in ancient Mesopotamia. Enki is supposed to be the one who sent forth the Apkallu to bring the gifts of civilization to humanity. The Apkallu, according to Amar Anus, that scholar I mentioned earlier, were the Mesopotamian versions or conceptions of the Watchers from the Book of First Enoch. Same idea. It's these divine wise men who came forth and taught humanity things that we weren't necessarily supposed to know. Now, the Mesopotamians, like the Greeks with the daemons, had a better opinion of these entities than the Israelites and the Jews did. But it's the same group that we're talking about here. And again, in a later Babylonian text, the chief god Marduk sends the Apkallu, the Watchers, down to the abyss and tells them never to return, which again is the fake news version of God sending these entities to Tartarus.
Right.
Okay. So this tower, this ziggurat at the city of Eridu, according to archaeologists who excavated there in 1949, found 18 levels to this tower going back to about 5,000 BC using their numbers. I know that doesn't track with people who use a literal biblical chronology, but for the sake of argument, very old. There is a break in between two levels separated by an 8-foot thick layer of silt deposited by a massive flood. Then above this level, you got above that flood level, you've got several more layers. The top layer, they said, would have been the biggest ziggurat in all of Mesopotamia. This was a really important religious site. In fact, down to the time of Nebuchadnezzar in the 6th century BC. So 2,500 years after the end of the Uruk period, the kings of Babylon would still refer to themselves as the king of Babylon at Eridu. They would make reference to this spiritual place. That's how important it was. But the archaeologists found that at the end of the Uruk period, again, 3,100 BC, 2,500 years before Nebuchadnezzar, roughly, suddenly the construction on this massive ziggurat, the E-Abzu, or House of the Abyss, was abandoned, and it was very soon thereafter covered over by drifting sand. Well, gee, that sounds like Genesis 10. They left off building the city. But again, if this happened in 3100 BC, and Babylon itself wasn't founded until 2300 BC, and didn't become important until about 1750 BC under Hammurabi the Great, putting Nimrod in Babylon is a mistake.
Because again, Nimrod would have lived what period BC?
In the 4th millennium BC. He probably, if he was the builder of the tower.
Okay.
And the Uruk period ended and the construction on that ziggurat ended at 3100 BC. He missed Babylon by about at least 1400 years. 1400 years. Now, there was a Semiramis. She is a historical character, but she was a queen of Assyria who ruled toward the end of the 9th century BC. So Nimrod would have missed her by about 2300 years.
Yes. Okay, so what about, well, go ahead, but I was just going to ask you about becoming a Gabor and Gilgamesh and then Mighty Hunter. Is it against the Lord or are we reading that wrong? So, but go ahead.
Gilgamesh, yeah, a couple of generations, according to the Sumerian king list, after Enmerkar. Now, there's some question as to whether Nimrod was the builder of the Tower of Babel at all. Our friend Dr. Doug Petrovich, who's an excellent scholar, makes a case that it was Sargon the Great. Sargon the Great was Nimrod. Wow. And that, because the Bible doesn't say, we assume Nimrod built the Tower of Babel, but the Bible doesn't say he did.
Okay.
So that's extra biblical sources. So yeah, Tower of Babel, probably at the end of the Uruk period, 3100 BC, Nimrod might've been Sargon the Great, 2400s BC, 24th century BC. But still, he still would have missed, you know, Semiramis by a long period of time. Again, Hislop, was just way out. And by the way, his depiction of the, what he said were the priests of Dagon with their, you know, fish shaped hats.
Yes, right.
That's actually one of the Apkallu. Scholars know that there were three types of Apkallu. There was a bearded man with wings. There was a bird-headed humanoid with wings. And there was a guy who was wearing like a fish cloak. And that's who Hislop identified as Dagon or the priest of Dagon. Now, Dagon was a grain god. He was not a fish god. He was the equivalent of Enlil in Babylon, El of the Canaanites, Asher of the Assyrians, the Ammonites called him Milcom, which means the Hebrews called him Molech. But he was known to the Romans as Saturn and to the Greeks as Kronos. He was not a fish god. Hislop got that wrong. That was one of the Apkallu. So now of course I rabbit trailed. Now I've forgotten
I was going to ask you about becoming a Gabor because I know there's you know, debate on whether he actually did some occult sort of thing to maybe epigenetically become a giant or a Rephaim of some type. And then was the phrase in the Bible, Mighty Hunter against, or does it say against? I'm drawing a blank, but was it actually meaning as opposed to the Lord, in opposition to the Lord?
Well, that's a good question. And I'll be honest, we have not really studied that.
Okay.
Let's see, I'm going to go back here and see if I can find that. That's Genesis 11:10. Yes, Nimrod was a mighty hunter before the Lord. The Net Bible renders that he was a valiant warrior on the earth. The Septuagint, he was the first to be a giant on the earth. We always think of the Septuagint because that was the version translated into Greek from Hebrew manuscripts around 200 BC. So it helps us to understand what the Jewish religious scholars in the Second Temple period thought about their texts. He was the first to be a giant on the earth, and they specifically chose the Greek word there, gigas, giant. So epigenetically, that is possible, and that's really in Sharon's wheelhouse. She, her degree is molecular biology with an emphasis on genetics. We do believe that God destroyed all of the giants, all of the Nephilim in the flood of Noah. There was not, you know, Og was not hanging onto the ark or anything like that. And we wrote about this in the Book of Veneration because of the reference to the descendants of the giant or descendants of the giants in 1 Samuel 21, when David and his men go out and they have to defeat these other giants, one of whom almost kills David, named Ishvi ben Ov. Turns out that the phrase used descendant of the giant is not a Hebrew word that means literal genetic blood descendant of. That word yeledeh means one who's a member of a group into which one has been initiated or consecrated. So it's like a warrior cult, and the ha-rapha, the rapha, singular form of Rephaim, or the giant, would be, according to the scholar who wrote the paper on this, his name is Conrad LaRue, would be the object of their veneration. So these were devotees of the Rapha.
Speaking of name,
Ishvi ben Ov means son of the owner of a necromantic ritual pit, like the Ov of Endor, okay, the medium of Endor. The word in Hebrew, Ov, is usually translated medium, but it more properly means necromantic ritual, owner of a necromantic ritual pit. Wow. As you remember in that story where Samuel was summoned, he came up from the earth. He came up from the ritual pit. I go into that, a deep dive in that in my book, The Second Coming of Saturn. That's an ancient practice that you can trace back to the Hurrian people, the Horites of the Bible, who came from the plain of Ararat in the middle of the fifth millennium BC. And yeah, that's the Ararat below where the ark came to rest.
Right. Yeah. Luke, you were going to say?
Yeah, so I'm assuming you don't believe there was a second incursion of the Watcher's sin.
I'm you know,
it sounds like what you're describing, and maybe this is what Nimrod did, through his pagan practices, changed himself that way through the sin iniquity that he did and his alignment of his free will to the occult.
And if I can add, possibly through the line of Ham, as some have suggested.
Well, there are some who've suggested that. I tend to not think that that's possible because that suggests that God was not capable of executing his purposes.
Yeah.
You know, he's going to get rid of the sin that had been worked upon humanity. The whole earth is corrupt. I'm going to make an end of all living flesh, but I'm somehow missed that Ham's wife was right, part Nephilim or something. I'm open to the idea that maybe there was a second incursion. I mean, you know, the stories of the succubi and the incubi throughout history would suggest that maybe there's something going on supernaturally. Are those demons? Are those literally fallen angels? Not sure. But we can't prove the existence of supernaturally enhanced humans. So Sharon and I, rather than trying to replicate the work of L.A. Marzulli or Steve Quayle, who've been out there trying to find, Tom Horn, been trying to find this evidence, physical evidence, for a long time. You know, L.A. Marzulli with his On the Trail of the Nephilim series. We look at the texts, the ancient texts, and we can document, thanks to the work of secular archaeologists and epigraphers, that the Canaanites around ancient Israel and the Amorites back as far, at least as far as the time of Abraham, and the Hurrians going back at least to 3500 BC, were summoning these spirits from the netherworld. That's really going to be the focus of our next book, The Gates of Hell, that they were trying to contact or reestablish contact with the spirits, the gods who once walked among us, who are now on the other side of this watery abyss, or, you know, in this bottomless pit. We need to summon them from the netherworld to, you know, curry their favor. We can document that that is, we can document specifically that the Amorites who lived around Israel venerated the Rephaim specifically.
Yeah.
And there's been many generations that have done the same thing. And I would think that the Nazi party did so as well.
Well, it has been done in many ways through. In fact, the book is going to go into a few different ways of doing this. I mean, the UFO phenomenon with the contact made by,
right,
you know, the Ashtar command with you know, experiencers or contactees. I mean, why don't they ever use a webcam? You know, they cross the galaxy to get here. Why is it always telepathic? It's because it's spiritual. That's why.
Right.
People who are doing the ayahuasca trips, you know, yes, taking DMT. What are they doing? Well, they're opening up. They're literally opening up the gates of hell.
Yeah.
To themselves. And the bottom line is, the book is this, is going to make this point. There aren't necessarily certain physical locations on Earth where there are portals to the netherworld. The portal is like right here, you know, and right here. It's between your ears and it's in your heart.
Yeah.
You're going to open yourself up. You become a portal.
Now, I would wonder though, if there is some benefit on location, because Thomas Horn did the research there in Arizona where the Catholic Church put the Lucifer device. Mm-hmm. You know, there is something historical or significant, and maybe it just comes down to atmosphere.
Well, that was the mix.
If you
that was the
practice
mix.
Enough sin,
well,
in
a
given area, yeah, you're defiling that land, and you're allowing, until it's cleansed, you're allowing the enemy more freedom,
yeah,
in a given area.
Just to clarify, it's the Max Planck Institute in Germany that operates the Lucifer device, not the Roman Catholic Church.
Oh,
okay.
The Catholics have an observatory up there on the mountain, and they may share information with the operators of the Lucifer device, but it's not the Vatican that put it there.
Okay.
But you do raise a point. In fact, I discussed this on my podcast, A View from the Bunker, here a couple of months ago with Dr. Judd Burton, Doug Van Doren, Brian Godawa on portals. Why did Jesus go specifically to Caesarea Philippi, the Grotto of Pan, you know, the
right
cave at the base of Mount Hermon, and then 6 days after declaring his divinity there and saying, you know, on this rock, this 9,200-foot mountain that's essentially the Canaanite Olympus right behind me, I will build my church, and the gates of hell, the big cave right over here that the Jordan River is coming out of, won't prevail against it. And 6 days later, he climbs the mountain for the Transfiguration. Why did he do that instead of just saying to his followers, okay, the Canaanites think this is where El meets with Asherah and their 70 sons. And none of that. This is not how that works. Forget all of that. That's all a lie. He didn't do that. So there may be something to the physical portals, but I also think the key is what people choose to invite into themselves.
Mm.
So just because you go to Mount Hermon or you go to,
right,
You're not going to be, you know, cursed, or you're not going to take a demon home with you. Pray against it, you know, be prayed up and be aware that you may be in for some spiritual warfare. But I think we can go too far in either direction. Yeah. Jesus clearly didn't discount the idea of the importance of certain locations. In fact, in the second coming of Saturn, I point out that when you look at the last week of Jesus' life, he divided his time between the Temple Mount teaching and teaching on the Mount of Olives. Why there? We go back 900 years from the time of Jesus. Solomon put a high place up there to Molech. And I would suggest that based on 2 Kings, that is why the rabbis, the priests, referred to the Mount of Olives as Har HaMashkith, which is translated into our Bibles as Mount of Corruption, but literally means Mount of the Destroyer. Who's the destroyer in the book of Revelation? That's Apollyon or Abaddon I argue that it's one and the same. Molech is Shemiyaza. He's also the destroyer, Abaddon or Apollyon. And Jesus showed not only by preaching like the Olivet Discourse there. It's like, here's what's going to happen for the rest of time when the Son of Man returns, et cetera, et cetera. He gets arrested there. He's crucified there. He's resurrected from there. And when he returns in Zechariah 14, he lands there and splits the mountain in half. So, yeah, there may be something about the Mount of Olives, too.
So you made me think of something earlier when you brought up the incubi succubi as a possible re-incursion method. You know, again, our show is based in this understanding of Genesis 6 and being able to provide the atheist, the agnostic, the critic of Christianity a better answer for why did these wars against these tribes happen, the haram that last one of them needed to go. And I'm wondering if you hit on it there when you were talking about being a devotee to this just incredibly dark, evil cult. You didn't necessarily have to have Nephilim blood running in your veins or Rephaim blood, but you were part and parcel of that whole thing. Do you think maybe that was kind of, when you look at these different tribes that was told to get rid of every last one, that it was some Rephaim, but then it was also probably devotees of that?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And coming back to Nimrod, I think that he was the first one perhaps to do that. Let's worship these spirits that are now floating around here, and I can hear them. I can talk to them, and they promised me power if I do these things. I think that is a plausible explanation. And Sharon has floated this idea too, that epigenetically scientists are now beginning to find that certain behaviors by fathers will have an impact on the information carried by their sperm for a long period of time. And I'm not, you know, up to date on the research here, but it suggests that there's a scientific truth behind the phrase, the sins of the father will be visited upon the son down to the third generation. That if the guy is doing something, and not just, you know, like taking drugs or drinking heavily, but committing a particularly violent crime, it will change the genetic information transmitted by his sperm. And so why not the occult practices of the pagans and the rituals that they were performing, inviting spirits in to gain power? Think in the more modern sense, think of the Viking berserkers who were, according to those who faced them on the battlefield, impervious to pain, heat, cold, fire. They were just so devastating on the battlefield that the Viking kings finally, after 100 years of using berserkers, mutually agreed, even those guys who didn't like each other. Okay, let's not do the berserkers anymore because they're killing everybody. They kill their own guys. They just kill everybody. So I think that may have been the Goliath and his buddies, the Philistine giants. Yeah, Goliath was abnormally large. There was a really good paper recently by Dr. Clyde Billington who explained difference. Yeah. The difference between the 4 cubits in a span in the Septuagint and the 6 cubits in a span in the Masoretic text. Goliath probably about 8 feet tall.
Yep.
Okay. Really big. We've got some people who approach 8 feet in relatively recent history. Some who get higher than above that, like Robert Wadlow of Alton, Illinois. But
he generally they wear 200 pounds of armor.
Yeah, they right. They were not, they generally have some physical issues that Goliath didn't seem to have.
Yeah.
So how did they get that big? Were they demonically infused? That could well explain it.
Well, you made me think of something real quick. Luke, do you recall, this might have been a guest on Blurry Creatures, but they were talking about becoming a shapeshifter and having to murder someone close to them in order to get the ability to shapeshift. And that, to me, sounds right in line with what you're saying, Derek.
Well, that specific example, I don't remember, yeah. But Dr. Laura Sanger wrote in her book, dealing with the Nephilim and its ties to the Federal Reserve, that there are markers or sinned iniquity traits that if you were to do certain things, the shedding of blood, some of these like sex magic and some of these other things. And then obviously if you've got a genealogy of unrepentant individuals, the sins do pass on from the forefathers. You know, you're building up this iniquity force where it's you're just more and more and more full of demons, essentially. Mm-hmm. That there's this, it presents you the opportunity, just like an individual that gets closer and closer to the Lord, you know, by walking holy, and you got holy generational seed. We talked to Tim Bentz, right? Yeah. And he talked about the benefit that he had of his forefathers being Christians, and how just him being born, it was a benefit to him, his forefathers, where he had a greater sensitivity to communicate with the Lord.
Right.
Well, the same is true on the other side. If you got this iniquity force that's taking place of unrepentant individuals, it's going to work in the opposite.
Yep.
For sure. Wow. Well, that hour flew by fast, guys. Derek, thank you so much. Boy, I wanted to touch on current events with the eclipse and the red heifer in Israel, but we will have to chat another time about that. By the time this episode posts, that eclipse will have already happened. And actually, Derek, you've chatted with Rod Smith on the Millennial Mustard Seed a few times. Rod and I just did an emergency broadcast, he called it, talking about that eclipse, because when you start digging into that, there's some really fascinating things going over seven cities named Nineveh this time around. But with the time we have left, why don't you just kind of plug your website and any books that you wanted to highlight, Gilbert House Ministries that you do. Whatever you want to share.
Well, appreciate that. Basically, the easy thing is just go to our website, gilberthouse.org, gilberthouse.org. That is sort of the web hub for everything that we do. Links to our programs, Unraveling Revelation, which is our weekly broadcast program dealing with end times prophecy. We've been spending, I think, the last 3 months just sort of peeling away at Mystery Babylon layer by layer. Kind of agree with Joel Richardson about the role that Islam will play as far as being that global religion, that mystery religion. But I don't think the Antichrist is going to be a Muslim. I think that's a little too obvious.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah, it's who knows? We'll find out when that happens. Anyway, gilberthouse.org. All of our programs are there. Our books are linked there. Our store is there. We've always got some kind of a special going on in our store. And, of course, our books and videos. Books, anyway, generally available at all major bookstores as well, Barnes & Noble, Amazon. But if you want them signed, go to gilberthouse.org/store. We've got a trip to Israel planned for next spring. We're calling it our Iron and Myth Tour with Judd Burton and Doug Van Dorn. Timothy Alberino is also joining us because his tour, which was we would have been in Israel like getting ready to go right now if it hadn't been for the conflict with Hamas. So we backed it up to November, and then we thought, okay, it looks like the thing is going to extend as they are going to probably go into Lebanon, it looks like.
Yeah.
And besides, we've got an election coming up, and who knows what's going to happen between now and November. So next spring, information is at our website, gilberthouse.org/travel. But again, just go to the website. And while you're there, download our app. Download our app, because we've not been canceled yet. We've had individual programs pulled because we've said something. But your viewers or your listeners may be aware that Skywatch TV's YouTube channel has now been spiked for the fourth time. And as with previous cancellations, it had to do with a program dealing with the subject of child abuse and child trafficking.
Wow.
So why does YouTube seem to have a problem with exposing that sin? I don't know.
Running cover.
Mm. Yeah. So anyway, the way to get around that, Skywatch TV's app is developed by the same developer that we use, but you'll find a link there as well at gilberthouse.org.
Okay. Fantastic. Thanks again, Derek. Appreciate your time. Yeah.
My honor. Thank you.
Yeah. All right. Well, with that, we will sign off on the Days of Noah podcast, everybody. Thanks for listening. Please remember to like, share, and subscribe, and send it to your family and friends. Thanks, guys.